I'm Amanda Riekert, and I'm going to be presenting some work that I did at the University of Kansas with my colleague Mike Fox, who's also in the audience today. And I do have available some abstracts of our article that came out this week in the Journal of Disability and Health about the same work that I'll be presenting today. So if you'd like a copy of that. I also wanted to say, I know there have been some requests for large print, and I apologize for not bringing that today. I had every intention of doing that and would be happy to make those available for people who would like them later on. I apologize again for not bringing those today. So today I'd like to talk to you about establishing the boundaries of disability and work. To do that, I will talk about the relationship between health and employment, the ADA and notable court cases, our methods, findings, and discussion from our research, and the anticipated outcomes and implications of the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act. Health and employment, as you probably already know, are inextricably linked. The link between them is very complex. As you probably know, a large number of people with disabilities remain unemployed, and this influences the type and amount of health insurance that they have. We do know that people with disabilities who are unemployed either remain uninsured or receive support through Medicaid. And we also know that people who are employed may and have high health care costs may be encouraged by their employer to not work because they're of fear of raising the cost for everyone supported by the same insurance. But laws such as the ADA have been implemented to prohibit discrimination that in part result in unemployment for people with disabilities and result in poor access to health care. The Americans with Disabilities Act was signed into law in 1990 by George Bush Sr., and it was intended to make the American society more accessible to people with disabilities. It's divided into five titles. Title I is employment, Title II, public services, Title III, public accommodations, Title IV, telecommunications, and Title V is miscellaneous. Our work focuses on Title I, or employment, and it's intended to provide people with disabilities equal access in the workplace. To ensure the passage of the ADA, Congress agreed to include ambiguous key phrases. For example, under the ADA of 1990, a person is considered to have a disability if he has an impairment that substantially limits at least one major life activity. But the Act didn't define major life activity, and this meant that it was up to the courts to have the final say in how that is to be interpreted. There are three notable Supreme Court cases responsible for how the courts have interpreted Title I and the definition of disability, especially over the last 9 years. Sutton versus United Airlines, Murphy versus United Parcel Services, and Toyota Manufacturing versus Williams. These are referred to as the Sutton Trilogy. And taken together, these Supreme Court rulings narrowly defined disability, especially related to the terms of mitigating measures, substantially limited major life activities, and regarded as clause. They limited the ability of the ADA to defend the rights of people with disabilities in the workplace, and they resulted in the lower court's overuse of summary judgment on the basis that the plaintiff could not prove that she had a disability. In our research, to talk a little bit about the methods, we examined all of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals cases from 1995 to 2005 that matched the Westlaw key number 1215, or discrimination by reason of handicap, disability, or illness. And we limited it to only published cases and cases that were specific to disability, not just procedural only. And this resulted in an N of 345 cases. Our dependent variable was whether the plaintiff or the person with a disability was victorious at the appellate level. Our independent variables were court characteristics, including what circuit it was brought in, the year of the ruling, the judge's age, political party, race and ethnicity, and gender. And the plaintiff characteristics included job class, disability category, and injury or not. The defendant characteristic, primary defendant characteristic, was whether or not the company was a Fortune 500 company member or not. And for our analyses, we used descriptive statistics, chi-square test, and multiple logistic regression analysis. So the question is, has the ADA helped in Title I? Well, the terms such as substantially limited and being regarded as an impairment and major life activity are still being interpreted. In addition, there's still much debate about whether emerging disabilities such as chronic fatigue, ADHD, or carpal tunnel syndrome qualify as disabilities. And other questions remain as well, such as where are the lines of accommodation drawn? What constitutes undue hardship for employers? And what constitutes discrimination? The number of ADA Title I cases brought to the circuit courts reached a high of 51 in the year 2001, and by 2005 it had declined to 20. So we haven't seen an exorbitant number of cases brought to that level. But we expect that this will increase with the implementation of the ADA Amendments Act, which I'll talk about again in a minute. The large majority of the plaintiffs, over 61%, had a chronic disability such as MS, obesity, epilepsy, or lupus. And 28.7% of the cases involved an injury, and the majority of those injuries occurred at work, 74.2%. Also, more than 82% of the claims were against companies that were not Fortune 500 members, or what they were, in other words, they were smaller companies. Judges were primarily male, white, appointed by a Republican president, and had a mean age of 70.8 years. And this didn't differ significantly from the judges that were sitting in the year 2005. Our research indicates that 71% of the published judgments were in favor of the employer. That is, most of the time, it was not in favor of the person with a disability. And what influenced that most was the circuit it was brought in, the political party of the judge who was ruling the case, and the company size. So plaintiffs who brought their cases in circuits 2, 3, 9, or 10 were more likely to have success. And if they were in front of a Democratic judge, they were more likely to have success. And if they were competing against the Fortune 500 company as an employer, then they were more likely to succeed. So from the literature, we've learned that the circuit court outcomes are influenced by narrow interpretation of disability by the courts. And as a result, lower courts finding that many people don't meet the definition of disability despite having limiting impairments, and that it requires extensive resources for plaintiffs to succeed in litigation, because it takes a long time, especially. And this is very prohibitive for bringing litigation for most people with disabilities, and it, as a result, limits the protections of the Americans with Disabilities Act. But from our study, we also see the additional influence of the circuit where litigation occurred, the judge's political affiliation, and the employer's company size. The good news for people with disabilities is the newly signed ADA Amendments Act, at least we hope. Okay. George W. Bush signed it into law last month, and it takes effect on January 1st of next year. It's intended to restore the original intent of the ADA of 1990 to more fully remove barriers for people with disabilities. How broadly it will be defined is still to be determined by the court system, again. However, the ADA Amendments Act completely rejects the reasoning and standards of the Supreme Court in the Sutton Trilogy. So how does the ADA Amendment change the ADA Amendments Act, I should say? First, it defines the key phrases of major life activities, also substantially limits, and regarded as. Did I go to the wrong thing here? Did I not type that in? Yeah, I guess I didn't put that one slide in. I apologize. Second, it states that having an impairment should be determined regardless of the mitigating measures, or whether the impairment is episodic, short-term, or long-term. And those things both are in direct opposition to the Sutton Trilogy findings and should increase, I'll get to that in a minute, increase the number of findings in favor of the plaintiffs. The Act shall have a more broad interpretation. And fourth, people with disabilities can now claim discrimination, whether discrimination is based on the actual disability or not. Generally, these changes should result in more accommodations upheld for people with disabilities, more individuals protected, and more suits brought to court. In sum, the impact of the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act of 2008 are difficult to predict. I know, it went too far. But they will be substantial, and given that it reverses much of the narrow interpretation of the Supreme Court, it should create an increase in accommodations. These increased opportunities for full participation, especially in employment, for people with disabilities will lead to better health outcomes. Thank you.